From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made a couple of weeks ago when James Shepherd announced his full platform as a candidate for mayor of Rochester. Shepherd is the former Rochester police chief and now a Monroe County legislator. And this hour, Jim Shepherd is back in studio with us as we continue our series of interviews with the candidates for mayor, our chance to explore his platform at length today. So with that, we welcome back the candidate, Jim Shepherd. Welcome back. Nice to have you here in studio again, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm going to start with just, you know, sort of how you're viewing your first foray into a campaign like this. I know you're spending a lot of time in forums, meeting directly with voters. What are you hearing most often when you're out there, Jim?
Well, I think the thing that I hear most often is from no matter who it is, whether it's developers, business people, community organizations, individuals at the door, is that they want to be involved in the process. They want to have a transparent process where they know if it's about an RFP, they want to know what the process is and they want it to be uniform and consistent. It's in terms of neighborhoods. They want to have more help from the city. They want the city to participate in beautification and making things more engaged. And in terms of transparency, you know, like I said, people want to know what's going on, and then inclusion. Everybody wants to be included. Everybody wants their ideas at least to be listened to, and if you can incorporate them, that makes it even better.
Does that mean right now they're telling you that they don't feel like they're at the table?
That is correct. You know, if you, in terms of neighborhood groups, you know, there's any number of neighborhood groups that have banded together to form many neighbors building neighborhoods, and the reason they came together was they felt their individual voices were not being listened to. And so as a result of that, in the communications that I've had with some of these organizations, is that they want to be heard, they want to be included in the process, whether it's a development, whether it's beautification, whether it's just hearing how policing should be done, they want to be included in the process.
Where do you think you differ most strongly with the current mayor?
I think there's a number of areas that we differ. The first two that jump to mind, number one, in terms of leadership. You know, I've had the benefit of working through an organization from being a foot soldier to being the chief of police. And during that process, I had the opportunity to go through any variety of trainings, any variety of experiences that prepared me for this position. You know, so often people think of Shepherd as just the chief of police. The fact is, I had the opportunity to work in the city school district. I was the director of school safety and security. In that position, had wonderful insights in terms of schools, talking with administrators, talking to teachers, talking to students. In my current employment, that's the same thing. I work with young students. I work with college students. And it just gives you a broad breadth of life experience that you bring to the forefront in terms of leadership. And when I talk about leadership, for me, it's about listening to people, soliciting their input, forming alliances, collaborations, just being someone who doesn't necessarily have all the answers, but somebody who's willing to listen and solicit and include.
Your leadership, when you were a Rochester police chief, and I take the point, you know, you're a man who's been more than just a police chief, but your leadership as chief has been questioned by your political opponents, so let's talk a little bit about that. First of all, let's back up and let's talk about what's led to some of those questions, which is the question of what happens with civilian review of police conduct going forward. What's your position on civilian review?
I think in terms of civilian review, what we need to have, what we have to have is a process in which all the parties involved have faith in it, and they believe in it, and they have trust. And I think based on the dialogue that we've heard, and it's not just in Rochester, but I think all across the country, what we have is a system that needs to be reviewed, revised, changed so that the community feels they can trust it, the officers feel they can trust it. You know, I talk about four words that have to be incorporated in whatever system we push forward: complete and thorough, fair and impartial. You know, and if that's the process and that's what it includes, I don't think anybody's going to complain what's put on the table.
When it comes to your tenure as police chief, again, you were appointed chief in November of 2010 and left that post at the end of 2013, just before Lovely Warren became mayor. So in those roughly 3 years, a report shows police internal affairs recorded 203 allegations of police misconduct and that you as chief sustained none of them. Now, there are some, according to the Democrat and Chronicle, some discrepancies in the data, and the Civilian Review Board recorded 191 allegations and showed you sustained three of them. Internal Affairs said you sustained four of them, but regardless of the number, it's not a big number. And so essentially what people are saying is, look, when you were the chief, you know, you were reflexively pro-police no matter what happened, and that had an impact, that had a negative impact because it didn't lead to sort of an open process, or at least a process that gave a chance for complaints to be heard. What do you say to that, Jim?
I think when you talk about, again, when I talk about my career, you know, I spent 5 years in internal affairs, professional standards. Any number of cases were sustained by my office and then supported by the civilian review and by the chief's office. And I'm sure that there's more cases than what has been cited relative to what was sustained during my tenure as chief. Not to get into specifics, you know, I can think of instances, particularly when I worked in internal affairs, where officers were arrested, officers were terminated, officers received 60-day and 30-day and 10-day suspensions. So the process is to find the truth. And, you know, a lot of times when there's complaints, and, you know, this is one of the things that I think is most frustrating for civilians, is the fact that if you make an allegation against an officer and it's just your word against his, in our process, unless there's some other evidence that's going to come to light, it is going to be unprovable just based on the nature of the process. And so that's the majority of instances of what occurred. Then also in terms of use of force, you know, a complainant may say that excessive force was used, and our investigation may determine that inappropriate force was used or unnecessary force was used, because I think there's differences between the terminology. You know, an example I would give you, if somebody were to hit you, push you, would that be excessive? No, that might be inappropriate, might be unnecessary. If somebody were to hit you with a nightstick 14 times, under circumstances, that may be excessive. And so I think we have to look at the totality of the complaint as opposed to just lumping them under a certain circumstance and saying you never found a sustained complaint relative to an excessive force investigation.
Do you think most complaints against police are frivolous?
It's not a matter of being frivolous. It's a matter of what I found is about courtesy. You know, a lot of the complaints are not about an officer using force. It's really about his tone, his language, the way he said it, the way he looked at you when he said it, the way he looked around your house, maybe in disgust based on the fact of your living conditions. Those are the things that really upset people, is that where they want to come forward and say something. The reality of it is that, you know, in my experience of being in professional standards section, being the chief of police, force is not the driver of complaints. The driver of complaint is, how did that officer talk to me? What he said to me? He cursed at me. He used the N-word, whatever the complaint is. And so, again, depending on the circumstances and the ability to find evidence to support it, that would determine the outcome. And I took great pride in finding truth. It's really, at the end of the day, finding truth, and then it is what it is.
Do you find yourself reflexively pro-police?
No, I'm not. You know, I'm glad you said that, too. I've had two outstanding life changes. Number one, when I left the police department in 2008, I went to the city school district. And I'll be honest that for most of my career, I looked at policing as the cure for everything. And if you put a pair of handcuffs on it, you didn't have a problem. And when I went to the school district, you really see these young adults in a different light. You know, and number one, as a director of school safety and security, I didn't have a badge, I didn't have a gun. So you took on a different way of interacting with people. You realized that, you know what, you have to engage, you have to communicate, you have to listen, you have to accept the fact that somebody's upset, and you're not in a place to say, you better be quiet. You listen to them and you calm them down. And so coming back to the police department, that's what really created the focus for me in terms of youth involvement, youth engagement from the police chief's position. You know, you talk about my 3 years and you talk about complaints that have come through the system, but you think in terms of my engagement in the community, going to schools, barbershop talks, walking in the neighborhoods. Those are the things that the majority of people who have interacted with me remember. It's not a matter of, you know, he's pro-police. I'm not pro-police. I just believe that I'm going to give everybody fairness. And that's the key thing. It's like being a judge. You don't want to be unfair to any party. And that's what I strive to be, was fair.
And Jim, I want to explore a little bit more of something you just said, make sure I heard it correctly, and then explore some of what might have led to it. I think what I heard you say was, you know, 2008, when you went to work in the school district, you know, by that point, you know, your mentality was, if there's a problem, you put a pair of handcuffs on it, and, you know, that sort of solves it. And you'd been in policing for 20 plus years at that point in your career. Do you think that that is a common viewpoint among officers?
I think one of the things that, and I've said this in the past too, is I think with policing, policing has sort of been done a disservice because they've been handed the problems of society and expected to solve them. So when we talk about crime, it's not about law enforcement. Crime is not going to go down unless you do something about poverty and education, particularly in this city. And so, but if you look at what the expectations are, and I think this is something that people need to understand too, police don't just decide what they're going to do. What happens in any community is that certain people in the community say you need to address this issue, whether it's loud booming stereos, people staying up late, people out on the street, boys on the corner, shots fired, violence. It's somebody saying you need to address this. And a lot of times in police departments, and you see it nationwide, they're ill-equipped in terms of resources. the problem is never going to go away unless you deal with the underlying issues. And unless we deal with those underlying issues, crime is always going to be a part of the mix. And so I just think that in terms of being in law enforcement, it's a hard job to have when the problems that you're told to address are not being addressed underneath.
And I know you've heard some of the specific complaints about individual cases from your political opponents. For example, one of the candidates who was on our program last week, Rachel Barnhart, her main complaint is she says, exactly what we've been talking about. She said Shepard's Internal Affairs Department never upheld allegations of excessive use of force. And she was upset that you have, in her words, quote, a history of talking about the use of force in a cavalier or joking manner. And for an example, she cites the case of Benny War, in which the officers were not disciplined after the arrest of Benny War. He was a person who filed a lawsuit. He was in a wheelchair when he was knocked out of his wheelchair in a confrontation with an officer. And your opponent, Rachel Barnhart, cites federal court records that indicate that, when you were asked if it's common to knock over suspects in wheelchairs during an arrest, you replied, quote, it depends on who is winning. And she says that is a cavalier or joking response and an inappropriate response to the use of force. What do you say to that?
I think when you talk about use of force, and I've always said this, and this is how we train our people, their actions dictate our actions. So if it's a matter of I tell you you're under arrest and you say no problem, you turn around and let me put the handcuffs on, that is a beautiful day because I didn't have to use any force. I didn't have to raise my voice. I didn't have to do anything. There's going to be instances where people decide they don't want to go to jail. And in those instances, they're going to push. They're going to fight. They're going to do whatever they do to escape, get away, not let that happen. And so from my point of view, it really is the appropriate response for what you encounter. An example I'll give you is if you're making an arrest on a girl who's 75 pounds wet and you know that you can, basically get those handcuffs on without doing any other techniques that we train, that's what we would expect. Then you might have another scenario where you have somebody who's 250 pounds and they're acting in the same way. And the fact of the matter is you're in a losing position. You may use force that's totally different. And every circumstance has to take into consideration all of the circumstances that are in play.
And in case of Benny Ward, this is a guy in a wheelchair, right? I know you've seen the video, you reviewed this. And I'm curious to know if, number one, you felt like anything, when you look back now, was anything done incorrectly there? Was that a case where you say, look, the guy got knocked out of the wheelchair, but there was a reason for it. The officers were not acting inappropriately.
If you look at the video, and I don't want to, go into the nitty-gritty of this particular case, because when you talk about it, you say, man in a wheelchair thrown on the ground.
It sounds
like this is terrible. But the fact of the matter is, this individual was a large man. He probably was 250, 300 pounds. When they decided to make the arrest, they grabbed the wrist, and he started to pull away and strike. Now, at that point in time, and, from what was articulated was, as they grabbed his arms and tried to direct them behind his back, boom, the wheelchair tipped over. Then they struggled until another officer came to assist them to put those handcuffs on. So, when you look at the totality of the circumstances, you look at the video, you look at the other statements that everybody else put on the table, it isn't as it's being reported or how it's being described, just a gentleman in a wheelchair that officers use force.
Okay. And then the last question about that then is, did you say, that is it, if it's common to knock over suspects in wheelchairs, quote, it depends on who is winning. Did you say that?
I can't say I recall that, but at the end of the day, again, it comes into play in terms of the force you use is dependent on the subject's actions. And so in that circumstance, if you're unable to accomplish the arrest, you're going to use force. I mean, that's basically how we train them, is you respond to their response to your verbal, your response to your hands-on, your response to the tactics you use. It's all dependent on what they do. And I think that's the key thing that anybody should take in consideration when we have these discussions about use of force. It's not that we teach our people that automatically you hit somebody, with a nightstick. No. But there may be a time when that's appropriate just based on their response to what you're trying to accomplish.
All right. One more question then that comes in the course of this campaign. Your opponents have also brought up the Emily Good case. Emily Good was a citizen who was trying to videotape or record an arrest. And, so she ended up being arrested. Later, the charges were dropped. And officers did write some parking tickets to some of the people who supported her, some of her friends. And one of the allegations was, well, those officers were just writing parking tickets in retaliation to them. Do you think your officers were doing that in retaliation?
I think at the time that we spoke on this, I said my officers were wrong. And we knew that it was in response to her actions. And I also want to talk about Emily Good's arrest, because The fact of the matter is we acknowledge that we were incorrect. We went through a whole department-wide training relative to the rights of citizens to videotape. I think you also saw this as a national issue at the time because in, all across the country around the same time, you saw people with their cell phones out recording officers and officers making arrests and then realizing that, guess what? You can't stop them from videotaping you doing your job. And so you haven't seen those anymore. And I don't think you've seen it in the Rochester Police Department. I don't think you've seen it in departments across the country. And that is something that you will find in terms of law enforcement is that we make mistakes and the good ones learn from their mistakes and train their people so they don't reoccur.
And so I think it is at least fair to point out that the Emily Good situation came up not long after the video on a cell phone became ubiquitous. You went your entire career where that didn't exist, and all of a sudden, that's out there now. But in your view now, that's more understood among officers in the department, that that's less of an issue now.
Well, the good thing about the video cameras and the cell phones and that whole piece is that, and I told officers this when it occurred with Emily Good, you should conduct your business like somebody's videotaping you at all times. And if you do your business with a good heart and you're acting in the best interest of the community, you have nothing to worry about. And so the fact that somebody has a camera or the fact that there's a camera on a building or in a store or anywhere else in this world, that should not be your concern. Your concern should be you do your job, you do it with integrity, and everything will be good.
As part of your platform, you want to establish two additional section offices by 2019. Why?
You know, when we talk about the reorg of the Rochester Police Department, and that goes back to almost like 2000. At the time, Chief Duffy and Mayor Johnson were looking at the structure of the police department and looking at ways that they could decrease the cost of public safety. And at that time, we went through a big study, and at the end of that study, it was decided that we would have two sections, east and west. To be honest with you, the people who were involved in it internally with the decision-making of that reorg opted or promoted a five-section model, basically four quads with a donut for downtown. As a result of the original East-West, I believe in 2003, the police department sort of quadded it and put a captain over each quad. And now we've moved into the place where we have downtown, so now you have four quads and downtown in the middle of the donut. And what I hear, and I knew it from past experience, is that people want to be able to have police that are in their neighborhoods, police that they know are familiar with, police they can go to a police station and say, these are my issues. And they want it to be close by. When I say close by, if you look at our current model, we have a downtown section, which generally only people are going to go there are the people who live downtown or work downtown. You have your East Division and West Division offices, which, say, for the East Division office, which is at Upper Falls and Clinton, people from North Winton and East Avenue aren't going to go over there to talk to a police executive. So people want to have a neighborhood connection to their police. And what I find, too, is that different geographies want different things from the police department. You know, in some areas it might be about boys on the corner selling drugs or booming with car stereo. Somewhere else it might be just due to the fact that people are illegally parking. And so you by having it quieted and having it different section offices, you can police based on the needs of the community that you're serving.
When it comes to this race, last week, one of your opponents brought up the issue of race. Rachel Barnhart brought up race and said that she believes you and her are splitting the white vote right now, that the current mayor is on track to get most of the African-American vote, and she thinks that your record as police chief makes it difficult for you to make inroads in the African-American community in this city. Do you agree with, in general, that framing right now?
I think in terms of my campaign, it's geared towards the citizens of the city of Rochester. You know, I have no desire to be a divider. I want to be a uniter. I think if you look at the issues that have hurt this community, that have hurt this nation, it's based on people wanting to divide and wanting to, you know, hold campaigns that separate people by demographics. I want to be the candidate that stands for everybody in this city, and not just in the city. I just want to be the guy who everybody in this region feels can do the best job. And in terms of my police record, I think there's any number of people that I've engaged, worked with over a 30-year career. I want to stress that, too. You know, over 30 years of police work in this community, my reputation is stellar because nobody's going to tell you that Shepard used force on them inappropriately. Nobody's going to tell you I stole their money. Nobody's going to say I falsely arrested them. And so if you look at my entire career, I'm proud of it. I think that the majority of this community knows that, and I think that whatever standing I have in this community is based on a long history of service.
We're talking to James Shepard, who is a candidate for the mayor of Rochester. You can call the program with comments or questions if you'd like, 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255. or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Whenever we have candidates on, we allow them to tell you where you can learn more about them. And there is a detailed platform now for Jim Shepherd. Your website is what, sir?
ShepherdForRochester.com.
ShepherdForRochester.com. So as we continue our discussion now, want to move on to questions on economic development. And, you know, you mentioned back in January, I think it was just about 5 months ago exactly, that we talked to you on this program, and you said one of the things that you wanted to do was get into this race for the right reasons, with the right intentions, but also open to listen, that you wanted to meet with stakeholders, community members, people in different neighborhoods, business leaders, and that your economic platform would come to represent not only your views, but also what you were learning from them. Well, you've had a chance to do that. You've rolled out a platform. What's at the top of the list for you, Jim?
I think the most important thing is to put together an experienced team that is familiar with the needs of business in terms of economic development, and put them together so that they can make the path easier. You know, so much of what I hear is that nobody understands the process. The process changes regularly. And I think that what we need to do is have an economic development process that includes business, developers, community input, and it's understood what the requirements are as you move forward.
And I think the current mayor would say that that's already the case, though, wouldn't she?
I can't speak for her in terms of what she might say, but I do know from what I hear that that's not the case. You know, when you think about the fact of Parcel 5, you know, Parcel 5 has been had a number of ideas thrown out there. You know, we had the casino idea, we had the movie theater, we had the water park, we had the casino with the Performing Arts Center. And I don't think that any of those were necessarily the combination of downtown stakeholders coming together and saying, this is what we'd like to see. And I think that's important. When you talk about vision, I look at it in terms of, you know, looking at this table and deciding how would we like this table to look in its perfect state. And that's how we should be looking at downtown or any part of the city. How do we want it to look in a dream state? And then working with the stakeholders to make that happen. If you're not doing it in that manner, what you have is where you're putting things on the table, but it may not work for all the stakeholders, and it may actually impede some of them's things that they have intentions to build or what they've already built. So, for example, if you were to put a movie theater next to your performing arts center, that might not be a draw that complements both. So you want to be in a position where you're taking the opportunity to work with all stakeholders and you're making that vision come true as opposed to doing it haphazardly.
And so when you mentioned Parcel 5. And so when it comes to Parcel 5, for example, is that a done deal now? Or if you're elected mayor, what do you expect to happen on that parcel?
Well, I believe that that is still going through the process of approval by City Council. Obviously, if City Council makes that a doable item, then we'll have to do with the consequences of that. I think that if City Council does their role, which is oversight relative to what the mayor puts on the table, I think they will take in consideration the fact of the money. You know, it's a project that at this point in time does not have the funding. And it's interesting when I talk about the funding, because the original RFP said that no state or public funds would be included. And now basically what's on the table is that there will be state and public funds put on the table. So I think that City Council, if they do their review and they do it properly, that might be something that may change based on the approval process.
What do you want to see there?
It's interesting you ask that question because, again, I think it's something that we should collectively make a determination of what this community needs. You know, and there's a lot of people who say that, you know, a performing arts center is what we really need. And one thing I do know about the Performing Arts Center and the 5 studies that have been done relative to that is that it is not self-sustaining. And does the city of Rochester want to be in a position where they are subsidizing another entity in this city? Because we subsidize the convention center, we subsidize the arena, Blue Cross Arena, we subsidize the soccer field. I believe the county subsidizes the ballpark. And so I don't think that's something we want to put ourselves into, that position where we're forced to subsidize things with taxpayer money when they're privately developed.
Arnie Rothschild from RBTL says that won't happen, that it will sustain itself, that once it is built, they will not ask for any ongoing subsidy. Sounds like you are a skeptic of that.
Well, again, and I'm just going based on the studies that have been done, and we can go back 20 years, and a number of studies have shown that based on the size of the venue, based on the number of days that they can be in operation, based on the money that they can charge for those shows, that it will not be self-sustaining. Now, if there's some study out there that shows that, you know, that's the case, then we can explore that down the road.
All right, let's get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back, talk more about economic plans from Jim Shepherd as he rolls out his platform as a candidate for mayor. And we'll take some of your phone calls. Pete and Gates will come to you. And if you want to call the program as well, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Jim Shepherd, candidate for mayor. There we go. That's okay, Rob. Let's roll them. Coming up in our second hour, do you know what the organization Refugees Helping Refugees is? It's the only of its kind in Rochester that was founded and run by refugees themselves, helping those like them as they transition to life in Western New York. Well, there is a musical benefit for them coming up, and we take a look at the great tradition in our country of musical benefits crossing cultural boundaries and helping unite people who truly need help. That's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and let's grab a phone call. Pete in Gates is on with James Shepherd running for mayor. Go ahead, Pete.
Yes, how's it going, Mr. Dawson, Mr.
Very good.
Shepherd?
Yeah.
Very good, sir.
Well, I just want to point out the other candidate made a big issue about that person in the wheelchair. You know, a person in a wheelchair can still have a gun. You know what I mean? It's not the fact the person's in a wheelchair. He wasn't cooperating, and a police officer has to make a split-second decision. You know, a person in a wheelchair can have a knife and be just as dangerous.
Pete, thanks for the phone call. James, what do you think?
Well, I'm not done yet.
Oh.
Yeah, and also, you know, the stop and frisk issues, not just in Rochester, but all of the country, is a police officer don't stop and frisk an old lady with a Bible going to church. You know, they know the same characters are out there every day in front of stores, and they know that some people have been arrested with guns before. So them are the people they're stopping and frisking. They're not stopping and frisking, you know, a family going to church, per se. So I don't understand, you know, you have a candidate that's never been a police officer making comments on how police work should be. You know, she doesn't have a clue what it is when you have to make a split-second decision.
All right, Pete, thanks for the phone call. Jim, Jim, go ahead. I've got. Thanks, Pete. I appreciate that. Go ahead.
Well, he raises two issues. Number one, he talks about the fact that you don't know the circumstances when you're arresting somebody, say the person in a wheelchair. You don't know whether they're armed. You don't know if they possess a handgun or whatever. And those are things that officers have to take into consideration in terms of their safety and the citizen's safety and everybody else involved in that circumstance. And again, I just want to express that, you know, when an officer is doing his job correctly, what dictates what he does is the subject's actions. And you can't just escalate to a high level because you want to. You have to be able to articulate the circumstances that, okay, I verbalized, that didn't work. I tried hands-on, that didn't work. And you escalate based on the resistance that you encounter. And that's important for the citizens to realize. He also talks about stop and frisk. I applaud him for asking the question because really what you see happening, particularly all over the country and here in Rochester, is people are using this term, and they're using it incorrectly in terms of what we have done in the past and what we may be doing currently. Stop and frisk is something that was legalized by the Supreme Court in 1967, which says an officer can stop someone and frisk them if they believe they have, are, or about to commit a crime. They're a suspect. And under those circumstances, you can pat them for a weapon. That's as far as it goes. Once you've determined that there is no weapon, you now have a general conversation relative to who they are, where they're coming from, and all that. In the 90s, New York City started stop and frisk, and they overstepped their bounds. Basically, they used it for every encounter, and basically it led to some problems. And here in Rochester, we did not embrace a philosophy of stop and frisk. What we embraced was a philosophy is if you are known to us, if we are known to be a gang member, if you're known to be a violent individual, we are going to engage you. And I think that's important because, you know, as a parent, as a father, as a uncle, brother, whatever, what you want is the police to be out there doing their job in a proactive way so that they're not just responding to violent events.
All right. So before I get back to your phone calls, some of these comments and Pete's phone call in particular has me thinking of Philando Castile and the recent judgment there. And one of the reactions we heard, particularly among those who were dismayed by the verdict, was that police officers in this country can simply say, I was scared, as a justification for just about any actions. And you know, it's hard to determine, was that officer actually scared or appropriately scared? And if the officer is scared of something, well, they might escalate it. And I know that's a simplification, but let me just ask first and foremost, do you think, from what you could see, do you think they got it right or wrong in the Philando Castile case?
I wish I could tell you I knew all the facts of that particular case, and I really don't. One of the things that does stand out for me is the fact that it went through the process of a jury, you know, hearing the case and making a determination. And I think that that's our process. Just take the police out of it. You know, in terms of any event that happens involving a citizen and hurting somebody else, if it goes through the process of a jury, every jury finding that I've heard, they never lined up with me if they, you know, necessarily found somebody not guilty. But that's because, as a policeman, I always thought that if I arrested them, they were guilty. But the fact of the matter is, with this particular case, I think there's more information that needs to be put on the table so people can know all the facts. And then if you have all the facts, you can make an educated decision based on what's been put in front of you.
Do you think that those who are saying if Philando Castile was a white guy, he'd be alive today, do you think that's right or wrong?
I can't speak on that. You know, I believe that the officer that was involved was Latino. I believe that, you know, one of the standards that it makes it hard for people to understand, it says a reasonable man standard. You know, when you say you're afraid, would a reasonable man under circumstances say that was a reasonable response? And I think that's key when you see these cases go before the criminal system, is would a reasonable man hearing what you say, not saying that everybody would act in the same way, but would a reasonable man concur that, you know what, under those circumstances, I can understand it?
All right, Jim Shepherd is my guest. Let's go down to New York City because our next caller is from Rochester. But Matt, currently living in New York City, is that right?
Yep, living down in New York. Grew up in Rochester, grew up in Pittsburgh. Love coming back to the city, love hanging out in Rochester. Came up for Father's Day weekend. Now I'm driving back listening to WXXI.
There you go. So, good for you.
So thanks. So my question is, you know, like I'm 28, 29 years old, married, living in New York. I would love to move back to Rochester. You know, what is your plan? What is your, you know, what do you want to do? How are you going to get young professionals to move back home? You know, what's your plan to bring in jobs or to attract startup companies to come to Rochester?
All right, Matt, stay there. It's a great question. What do you think, Jim?
I think it's an excellent question. I think when we talk to young adults and people in college or just leaving college, the first thing they want to do is be able to get a job. If they can be employed, that's what they want to have happen. And then sometimes if they feel that those opportunities aren't here in the city of Rochester, they're going to go elsewhere. So I think we have to have a concerted effort to bring additional employers to the city of Rochester so that these people don't feel that they have to leave. One of the things that I think that we can do is we can go and recruit. You know, so many organizations are in New York City because New York City is the hub of the business world, but all their employees don't have to be in New York City. And so if we go out down there and recruit them and tell them that the, you know, the rental fees here in Rochester and our high rises are so much less than they are in New York City, if we tell them that the cost of living is so much less than it is in New York City, they can move some of their back room operations here to Rochester. They can keep the CEO and the CFO in New York City so they can interact with the people they need to interact with, but you can move some of that stuff here to Rochester. And I think that's a key piece for us in terms of keeping, you know, our young graduates, people getting out of, you know, our local colleges here in the city. If there's opportunity, they're going to stay. If they don't feel there's an opportunity for them, they're going to go where the jobs are.
How are you going to communicate with those companies? You know, are you going to hand sell it as mayor? Is there going to be sort of a coordinated effort? How do you make that happen here?
I think we go to them. I mean, if you're going to sit back in the city of Rochester and wait for somebody to come to you and decide they want to move to this city, it's not going to happen because they have choices. But the best choices are made when somebody comes and puts it in your face. And I think that's what we need to do. You know, you make your trips. You go to New York City. You go to L.A. You go to your large cities and tell them, hey, this is what we have to offer. And when you show them that you have the infrastructure, you have the ability to make it easy for them, that you're willing to assist them in any way that you can make that happen. But if you're going to sit back and wait and hope that somebody comes, more than likely we'll be sitting and waiting for a long period of time. Another thing in terms of economic development is we have to start thinking regionally. So often in this city and this county, what we think of is our little fiefdoms in terms of whether it's Henrietta, whether it's Greece, whether it's Aranacoit, everybody's fighting for the same things. And if we take a regional approach and we promote that outside of our region, that is something else that potential employers will look for, because, you know, you look at the hubs that are thriving, whether it's Nashville, whether it's Raleigh, whether it's Denver, Salt Lake City. You look at these places that are thriving, The issue is, it's not just the city that's reaching out to them. It's actually a unified effort by the region.
You have, and I'll come back to Matt in a second to get his take on what he's hearing from you, but on your list of economic development platform ideas, you've got forge closer partnerships with area colleges. You don't think the city's doing that enough already?
I think we can do a much better job in terms of reaching out to our colleges. Right now, the U of R is the biggest employer, you know, in our region, and we need to be more interactive with them. We should be more sitting down with them in terms of what their strategic vision is and helping them make that happen as opposed to not being engaged. And I think, again, we need to take an approach where we know that they're opportunities there for young adults who are not necessarily going to college to have the opportunity to go there and work, and we need to take advantage of that as well. And then in terms of their efforts to recruit city students to go to that university, we should be complementing that as best as we can.
You want to require project labor agreements. Why?
Project labor agreements, we can ensure that those organizations that are involved in development hire city workers, hire minority workers, and I think that's important for making sure that there's good wages, livable wages for the people that they employ. When you don't have those project labor agreements, what you frequently have are delays in the development process.
And when it comes to wages, Gary wants to know, before I go back to Matt here for him to kind of weigh in again, Gary wants to know, many city residents work minimum wage jobs now. Would your guest support a $15 minimum wage in the city of Rochester?
I have supported a $15 minimum wage across the state. Definitely stood with, you know, Metro Justice when they were doing their efforts and working with the fast food industry. And I think it's important when we talk about minimum wage, it shouldn't be minimum wage. It should be livable wage. I think that's the key thing is that we have people who are making minimum wage and they're working two or three jobs. And I think that hurts us both in terms of how they raise their kids, both in terms of their engagement with their families. I think in terms of being able to be effective in their work as opposed to working an 8-hour day, you're working 16, 17, 18 hours a day. We should be much more thinking in terms of livable wage so that people can take care of, you know, having a home, take care of food, take care of their children, and do it in a way that benefits society.
All right, we'll go back to Matt on the phone, who's on his way back down to New York City. He's a Rochester native and would love a chance to come back in the future. What do you think of what you heard, Matt?
I mean, yeah, I think I definitely think that's great. You know, I think from what I'm seeing, visiting back home every so often, you know, there are great things happening. A lot of young people, you know, some young people are definitely coming back. And, you know, it's really exciting to see, you know, new restaurants, you know, opening up. And, you know, the music scene is really great. You know, I would just love to see the, you know, local governments really making a push for, you know, new jobs, you know, good jobs, smart jobs, you know, to attract, you know, young people to come back and, you know, have families. So good luck.
Well, Matt, thanks for the phone call. And this is your chance. Again, Matt's a perfect example of a listener who's now on his way out of town, wants to spend more time here, wants to maybe live here. And this is his chance to talk directly and yours to the candidates for Rochester mayor in our series of interviews. James Shepherd, our guest for the hour. ShepherdForRochester.com is his website to learn more. You can call 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255. Bill in Rochester, next up on the phone. Go ahead, Bill.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Oh, okay. I'm Bill Wishmeyer. I work with the Rochester International Community and the refugee community. And I just want to say that I support, and I know a lot of people from the refugee community support Mr. Shepherd. Since 2013, when we had a big issue with crimes against the different refugee communities, Mr. Shepherd, who wasn't even chief of police at the time, he stepped up to the plate. And over the last 4 years, he's invested his time and energy in getting to know who the various ethnic communities are. I think, you know, that's something that's very important. He's made them feel welcome. He goes to a lot of their different events and stuff. My question is, how are we going to, since Rochester and the community, along with the various colleges, we have a huge international community here that doesn't have a seat at the table. A lot of people don't even realize that we have refugees here, other than, you know, what's happened in the past with the Trump administration. But my question is, how are we going to engage them more into the community?
Bill, thanks for the phone call. Next hour, by the way, we're talking to an organization called Refugees Helping Refugees, which is just one local organization in that outreach. But go ahead, Jim. What do you think?
Well, I think it's very important that in terms of the refugee community, the immigrant community that Rochester welcomes. You know, I think that in terms of what we can do a number of things. We can use our rec centers as and libraries as a place where they can go and figure out how to work in the system, where they can get training, where they can learn English, where they can apply for their citizenship. And I think that's key for them to feel welcome. What I've noted during my time as as chief is that the immigrant community has contributed significantly to the betterment of our neighborhoods, you know, due to the fact that when they've come here from wherever country they come from, they come usually as an extended family. They have, you know, parents, grandparents, children all together. They come here as people of faith, regardless of what faith they have. They come here with values, with a work ethic. You know, they want to be able to work. They want to be able to go to work every day. They're going to give you, you know, a fair labor for the prices or the wages that you pay them. And so they have a significant opportunity to contribute to our communities for the better. I think the city also could have, which I intend to have, which is a liaison in City Hall who represents the immigrant refugee community, who will help me understand their needs so that we can meet those needs, and they do have a seat at the table.
Jim, I'm seeing a number of people reacting to some of your comments about economic development. Just kind of going back to what you said about how when you look at the cities on the rise, they are parts of regions that are on the rise. It's not just the city. But what we, at least what I think we know right now, is that Rochester needs jobs, particularly if you're going to fight poverty, close to home. And what some of our listeners heard you saying sounded like you would be a mayor who says, hey, if it comes to Rochester, great. If it comes to Henrietta, great. If these jobs go to Batavia, great. When what we really need is an aggressive hero for the city itself in all neighborhoods, in downtown. And let's clarify that. When you talk about this regional success, you know, some of our listeners took that to mean, wait a second, why are you not focused like a missile on the city of Rochester as opposed to the region?
Well, I think in terms of jobs, just think in terms of jobs. I think that this region has not done a great job. This region is not doing well in terms of job creation. I mean, the fact of the matter is that, you know, we have 90,000 plus jobs in this region, which we've lost 4,500 over the last 3 years. In spite of the claim that we've added 30,000 jobs or added and retained 30,000 jobs, if that was the case, everybody would have a job. I think we do have to think in terms of not just saying that you have to build a factory in one of our neighborhoods or whatever. I think working in collaboration, number one, with RTS. You know, our routing system is not geared towards getting people to jobs, but it was built on getting people to jobs. It was built on the fact that everybody worked downtown, and that was the routing system at the time, and that's how the bus system was set up. And we need to have those conversations on how can we best serve the people in need of employment. And when I say that, you know, the opportunity exists for us to take advantage of the fact that if we can get city people jobs, and if it's in Henrietta, great. Let's find out how we can get them to them jobs. I'm not going to give away the fact that, yes, I would love for every employer to put their jobs in the city of Rochester, and we'd like them on a bus line so people can get there easily and all that. But I think at the same time, we want them to have jobs in this region. I think what has hurt Monroe County is that we have taken a Rochester's on its own and the county's on its own, and we have not taken a unified approach. And like I said, if you look at other areas that have thrived, they have taken the opportunity to see it as a regional approach, and they have thrived due to that fact. And so I'm interested in everybody being able to thrive based on jobs, based on the opportunities being presented. And if those jobs are have to be provided with transportation, we find out means to make that happen.
All right, Louise in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Louise.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Shepard, I've really been impressed with everything you said. I do want to say something about jobs. My husband is an employer, small employer, and one of the things that we've noticed, not only in that realm, but also in issues of having our home redone, is that professional plumbers, electricians, craftsmen, do not have any young people that they're training. And I know that the Clinton Foundation has created, I don't know if it's a bylaw or what it is, but when someone signs on to do one of their commitments for building, et cetera, that for every 20 jobs, they must provide someone who is going to take on an apprentice. So I would like to see something like that in the city of Rochester so that we're tearing down the trade issue in schools, which is a bad idea. And that if we could do that, then a lot of young people who are not able to go to college or don't want to go to college would be able to make a good living.
All right, Louise, thank you. James, go ahead.
She raises an excellent point in terms of how we prepare our young adults. You know, everybody's not going to go to college. Everybody's not necessarily has a desire, nor do they have the aptitude to go. And we shouldn't be forcing kids on that track. I think we have a great opportunity to work with our trades, our construction, building trades, so that we provide exposure to our young adults to plumbing, electrical work, HVAC. By seeing these opportunities early, you can decide that, you know what, that's the career I want to do. And the fact of the matter is, and I say this all the time, you know, you take a plumber, he comes to your house, he's a plunger, and he's going to say, write me a check for $200. And a lot of these young adults don't realize that those are exceptional jobs to be able to raise a family and have a life. And so we need to expose them to it. We need to work with the building trades to put those apprenticeships within the schools so that as they're exposed to the opportunities, they get to work them, they get to explore them, they get to see what they like. And then if they choose not to go to college, we're putting them in a position where they can use those as pre-apprenticeships to be apprenticed and then eventually be within those trade professions. Everybody can't go to college. I don't think we need to be pushing college as the course that everybody needs to strive for. I think at the end of the day, what people want to have is a good job, a job that, you know, puts them in the middle class and a job that they can work, you know, 8 to 10 hours and be successful. And I think that a lot of our young adults don't know that those jobs exist. They don't know that they haven't been exposed to them, so they don't really see that as part of their vision. And if we expose them to it, they can make it part of their vision and they can make it happen.
Don't let me misquote you, but I think back in January you told me that your instinct on schools is that if you could have your way, if you could kind of wave a magic wand, countywide, something much more inclusive would be what you'd be looking for. But you understood that politically the will might not be there. So the question is, you know, in the intervening 5 months, have you shifted at all? How do you view your role as mayor when it comes to the schools, and what do you want to see?
I think in terms of the schools, the mayor has to be a strong advocate, a strong partner, particularly with the Rochester City School District. I've watched for 30 years as we've talked about mayoral control, and it really has turned into an adversarial relationship with the school district, and we have not moved forward.
So no mayoral control.
That's not in my wheelhouse. It's not in my vision. But I do think that we can work together to make certain things happen. You know, we talked about preparing kids through the trades. I think that's a must because everybody's not going to go to college and everybody's not going to be in a high-tech employment situation. I think in terms of diversification of the poverty and diversification of race, which we see, you know, the city being so segregated compared to the county, we need to do something. And I see value in that because if all you grow up around is whether it's majority people or minority people, you're not exposed to the diversity of life. And I think that if you have that opportunity to go to a school that is diversified, it's a plus for everybody involved. I know that Great Schools for All, they've done surveys. They've actually reached out to parents that live in the suburbs, that have kids in the suburb schools, and they would like their kids to go to diversified schools. So we should take advantage of that. I'm a strong proponent for regional schools just to start the process. I'd like to see one at the Eastman Business Park. Why? Because, you know, that's high tech. They have the opportunity to go to a STEM school. They have the opportunity to engage with people who are employed in that profession, and they can see if that's really what they want to do, and they could use the same pre-apprenticeships and internships to make that happen.
30 seconds, which is an impossible amount of time to answer this question, but Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. Too early to be calling for any changes? Do you want to see any changes if you're mayor?
One thing that bothers me relative to the Anti-Poverty Initiative is the fact that I don't think we have all hands on deck, and I think we need to be all hands on deck. One of the other things is I don't think that we can necessarily just pick a small geographical union, one geographical area, and say that's the area you're going to work on, because the reality is people will move and they'll overload the resources that or the programs that you're providing. One of the things that stands out is Andrew Young, when he was in Atlanta, they put a lot of programs in place to deal with poverty, and what happened with the population increase from 6 million to 9 million because that was the place to go to get assistance.
All right, so you've got some ideas on what I changed there, and I hope you'll come back because I know before Election Day, September and beyond, Our listeners are going to want to hear more from you and your opponents, and we'd love to see you back.
I would love to come back. Thank you.
He always says yes when we ask him, and I say that about anybody who's in that category, whether they're in business, politics, etc. We love when people say yes. It's always great to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And by the way, that's been true of everybody who's running for mayor in this particular campaign. So you're going to hear, you've already heard from Rachel Barnhart, Lori Thomas, Jim Shepard. You're going to hear from Mayor Warren and others as we go forward. Short break, more Connections next.